Okay, first of all, let me thank Luis and the other organizer for having me here. It's very nice to be back. Okay, so like Ricardo's, the title of my talk doesn't really match the pamphlet, but it's going to focus on 3G detectors and in particular on compact binaries. It's also a bit random because I added a few things throughout the week depending on what was happening at this workshop. So in particular, I added this slide because I realized that there are a lot of students in the room and we have basically only been talking about compact binaries and today a bit about stochastic. And the only way in which other sources came out is when Saragossa asked a question about basically burst. So I thought I should at least mention that even though this workshop has been very CBC-centric, that's not the only type of sources we are after. We can also detect continuous wave from pulsars, any random explosion in the universe as long as it has a non-constant quadrupole moment, and then what Tom mentioned today, the stochastic background, either astrophysical or cosmological. Now, this said, as everyone else, I'm going to focus on CBCs only, but I thought at least you should know, if you've never heard of it, that there is more stuff out there than CBCs. All right, and I also want to show a plot similar to what Patricia had, which is a CBC waveform. I want to show it to underline a couple of things which will be relevant for what I say later, and that is how different parameters affect the waveform, at least qualitatively. So in particular, if you wonder what is the main thing that controls the duration of the waveform, or alternatively the frequency at which emerges, that would be at the zeroth order, the total mass of the system. Heavier means shorter in the frequency domain, and at higher maybe order the spins. The phase evolution, the phasing evolution is controlled at the leading order by the chair mass, then mass ratio and spins. The overall amplitude depends significantly on a correlated version of distance and inclination, even though masses and spins also contribute to it. And then what happens at the very end can tell you something about the nature of the compact object. All right, so keep this in mind because what parameter affects which feature of the waveform also tells you what kind of correlation you should be expecting between parameters. The other thing I want to say just very quickly, because I am part of the LIGO lab, is the detectors that we have online these days. Again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I just want you to notice that there are three of them which are current, which have been detecting gravitational waves. You can see that there are trees, which means they are on the ground. Okay, I will relax this assumption later of things being on the ground, so to say. Okay, and again, I'm going very quickly because Patricia covered all of this. Where are we with these detectors? We are pretty much in a situation where we have been taking data on and off for 5 years. We had three observing run, and the third one, which finished last year, lasted for roughly 1 year of calendar time. Each consecutive run saw an improvement of the noise. So in this plot, X is frequency and Y it's noise, lower is better. So every time the detectors go off for commissioning, when they come back, they are slightly better, and eventually they will reach a design sensitivity. All right, now if you convolve in your mind the type of frequencies that we are sensitive to with the morphology of the waveform and what it is affected by, you can make a plot like this, which has on the x-axis, very qualitative of course, on the x-axis, what part of your noise you would be improving if you could, right? High frequencies, or kilohertz, 100 hertz, 10 hertz maybe. And on the y-axis, the number of detectors that you have in your network. And you can try to affine and you know, place science goals in this diagram, basically. And that tells you if you are improving your detectors, if you have the money and you want to make something better, what feature you would pick on your detector depending on the science you want to prioritize. And overall, for most of these things, you want to have, as you can imagine, as many detectors as possible and a good sensitivity in the hundreds of Earth's region and maybe lower frequency. At high frequency, really, the main thing that you gain is better equation of state, as Katerina discussed earlier. All right, so of course I won't be talking about all of these things, but we can discuss if you want about them later. Right, so where we are with this then, it's that Patricia showed this plot. We have been observing for roughly 700 plus days of non-consecutive time and detected roughly 100 or 90 gravitational waves. Another way of projecting or showing this result, it's where we are in redshift space, that's similar to what Tom has shown today. We have been detecting now black holes binaries maybe to Z of one-ish at the point that we can even perform an inference on the evolution of the merger rate of black holes as a function of Z with some error bar. Now, this is great. However, the reason why I'm here is to show that even once the detector reached their design sensitivity, which I've shown in the previous, in the two slides ago, we will still be dealing with the detections which are in the local universe typically, so in here, a few hundred maybe binary black holes per year. Most of them will be a low signal to noise ratio, some of them will be a bit louder, and we'll have a limited number of sources with the M counterpart. So if you want to do better, and we do want to do better, we need to build pretty much something new, right? We refer to this something new as new generation detectors or facilities, right? There are different designs, which I'm going to discuss quickly in a second, but overall, we are talking roughly, when you say next generation or 3G detector, we are talking of something which has a strain sensitivity, so the vertical direction on the noise plot I shown you earlier, of a factor of 10 roughly better than LIGO at design sensitivity, broadband. And if you can build something like this, you will basically be able to detect binary black holes everywhere, no matter where they are in the universe, pretty much. Have signals to noise ratio on the excess of thousands and detect hundreds of thousands of sources per year, right? That's what we would like to do when it's targeting the second half of the 2030s. Right, so in particular, I'm going to be reporting about one of these possible way of building these next generation detectors, which is called Cosmic Explorer. I added a couple of slides because Cosmic Explorer as a name came up through this workshop a few times, but I don't think nobody ever said explicitly what it was, so I will. So we are thinking and talking about an instrument which is based on the current LIGO idea, so L shape, just 10 times longer, right? And a lot of the noise scale like 1 over L, so you roughly gain a factor of 10 sensitivity just by making it bigger. In terms of detector, we are thinking right now of two such detectors. They will be one 40 kilometers, so 10 times larger than LIGO, one actually 20 kilometers only. There are reasons why this may be a good idea, not just monetary reasons, they are related to the measurement of the equation of state. And one important thing I want to say is that given the space requirement and the geography and the history of the US, this implies that probably this will have a significant impact, if it happens, on indigenous land. And this is already now playing an important role in our consideration and the way we are building our project. All right, this observatory, once online, will be serving for maybe 50 years. With an idea similar to LIGO and Virgo. So basically, you would improve the detector keeping the same facility over and over. Yeah, Ricardo, go ahead.
Yeah, is it true that you don't keep gaining indefinitely by increasing the size of the arm, no? Because
no,
for high frequency, you start averaging out. See?
Exactly. So 40 kilometers is not a random number because it's a factor of 10. It's the point after which you start losing pretty much, more or less. OK. And in terms of price tag, we are talking of order of $2 billion. So this is a lot of money. And again, target hoped starting date in the 2035 or so. So this is what C is. Who C is also important for a reason I will mention in a second. So this started in a serious way with an NSF-funded project in 2019, order of a few million dollars that comprised multiple institutions and postdocs and students like Phil Landry, I don't know if he's still around, was part of this project. And the main deliverable of this grant was to produce like an horizon study that started attacking and showing things like cost, and technical risk of building Cosmic Explorer, scientific potential, and so on and so forth. Now, so we were basically a bit more serious than a few people, a few friends on a pub with beers. Now we're getting more serious, because if you want more money, you have to show that you behave like a project. So we are quickly morphing from a collaborative effort to a project structure. And that means that a few of you may have got email a few weeks ago asking for volunteers to help with the creation of the Cosmic Explorer project. We also have a Cosmic Explorer consortium that hopefully many of you are into, which right now comprises on the order of 400 scientists. There is a large overlap with the LSC, the LVK, but it doesn't have to be like this. And if you want to be part of this, let me know. It doesn't come with any FTE commitment. So it's just really for fun. All right, so we're building a project. We have an org chart. I won't go through it in detail. I'll just show that I am here. My job is the liaison with this science consortium. So if you have any question, you can talk to me. You will also notice that a lot of these slots still are free. So if you want to volunteer, and I stress volunteer, we are all doing this on a volunteer base right now, and very often on an interim base, for helping with the CE project, you can just let me or Matt Evans know. The one thing I want to stress before I go to the science is that we are holding monthly Cosmic Explorer science calls, where basically people come and present their short author work on R&D pretty much for 3G on the science side. Is a nice, easy to remember URL. He has a form where you can submit your request for a talk, and I will reply to you as soon as I can. Okay, as I said, the main outcome of the first grant with NSF was the production of a Cosmic Explorer Horizon study. This is online, you can read it. It's 170 pages or so, and it covers a lot of things. The one maybe plot I want to get out of that is this one, which is tentative timeline of where and when C could happen. So we are here where the red arrows are. We just finished this Horizon study, and we are now in the process of trying to get a next batch of money to pretty much start thinking more seriously about the design and these kind of things. The idea and the hope is to get the money at this point in time and then have science happening pretty much around the mid-2030s. I want to stress this because she knew in her talk had something like 2040s. Of course, it may happen, but if the stars align, it may happen before the 2040s, which is, of course, is relevant if you think about working with LISA. Okay, I'm gonna skip this because it's boring and I already convinced you of the one thing I wanted to convince you, and that is that things are happening. And that's not trivial, because I've been in this business now for a decade, and I've heard about some like ideas for detectors, but without, you know, seeing a progress of them becoming closer and closer to reality, that takes time and energy from a lot of people. So for CE and also for IT in Europe, this is happening, which makes me optimistic. Okay, I'll also skip the quick slide, but if you want to know more, there is a set of web page that includes all of the pretty much books that people have been written about next generation facilities. All right, of course, this won't work happen in isolation. In the 2030s and 40s, we'll have LISA taking data. We have already heard about it. And hopefully also similar efforts in China will pay off with other space observatories. The Australians are working toward a concept called NEMO, which is not quite a 3G detector in the sense that it doesn't give you a broadband factor of 10 everywhere, but rather focuses on what can be done on the kilohertz region if you are only interested in a question of state and you are willing to give away the low frequency sensitivity entirely. And finally, Einstein Telescope. We have all heard about it. It's another next generation idea. This is in Europe, it's a European project. Now, you don't see trees anymore. This is because Einstein Telescope is thought to be underground to improve the low frequency sensitivity down to the Earth's region. It's triangular, 10 kilometer arms. They have a rather mature design, and the important, relatively new update is that they were included in the European Strategic Forum for Research Infrastructure, which again means that These are serious projects where people are working, and the chances of happening are actually larger than zero. Okay, in the Sea Horizon study, we have identified three key science outcomes that can be reached with next generation detector. I want to stress, this is not the whole science that can be done, as I discussed with Sarah Gossan a few days ago. This is the thing that we thought were sure things that we can deliver that are very hard to do otherwise. Okay, so think about this as a minimal set of science that can be done. And roughly speaking, we use this like a kind of wheel plot. There are three areas. One is black hole neutron stars throughout cosmic time. The other is studying the dynamics of dense matter and extreme environment, things like equation of state, phase transitions, kilonovae, and so on and so forth. And then extreme gravity and fundamental physics, and you can see them in this plot here. Today, I will focus on the text in yellow, which is actually in a subset of this, only on black holes throughout cosmic time. And the reason why I think that's revolutionary relative to what we can do now, it's summarized by this plot here, where we call this the donut plot. If you are at APS, we have stickers with this. And this shows on the radial direction, the redshift, and the yellow points are basically neutron star binaries distributed according to the Madhao-Dickinson SFR. White points are binary black holes. And what the radial lines, sorry, what the circular lines are the horizons of existing detectors like LIGO, the O3 sensitivity, LIGO Plus, Voyager, and then 3G detectors. And the point this is making is that with 3G detectors, basically, you can see a 30-30 solar mass black hole anywhere, basically farther than there are stars in the universe. And you can detect all or most of the population of binary neutron stars. Tom, go ahead.
If this is like too in the weeds, tell me and I'll ask you after. But something that like we were, some subset of us were actually just wondering about it, like the Flatiron, is in different projections or different studies, there are very different horizon redshifts for binary neutron stars. So like, I don't know, I always think of a horizon plot from like one of Satya's review articles that's like neutron stars have a horizon in like maybe ET out to redshift of one. But then like, you know, newer plots like this are showing a redshift horizon out to like 10. And I was just wondering what the uncertainty was or what the difference between these projections are.
I don't know that it's an uncertainty rather than using different version of the PSD. So I think the easiest thing we can do is to sit together and you show me exactly what document it is. Yeah, I mean, again, when you're thinking about something 15 years in the future, people meanwhile have smart ideas, so the PSD changes, you know, as a function of time. Okay, so a version of the PSD then is this one. Again, to give people an idea, here lower it's better on the y-axis. And Avanced LIGO Plus and Voyager, which is a possible upgrade of Avanced LIGO in the same facilities, live here. And C and ET, as I said, are a factor of 10 pretty much broadband improvement over those. And the Australian idea for a neutron star equation of state observatory lives here in yellow. If you convert this improvement of a factor of 10 in how far you can see objects in the universe, you obtain the following remarkable plot, where I have on the x-axis the total source frame mass. Let's assume equal masses for this plot. So a neutron star would be here, 1509-14 would be here, and 1905-21 would be here. On the y-axis is how far you can see these objects in the universe. Avanced LIGO, once a design in the plus configuration, would be here. So as I mentioned, you can see maybe binary black hole, intermediate mass black hole if they exist here, up to Z of 2, 3. And stellar mass black hole, one-ish, and neutron stars basically in our backyard. And as you go to 3G, you can see pretty much stellar mass binary black hole up to Z of 100, which is absurd. So like, I really want to drive this point at home because it drives me crazy. This is the next generation, and we are going to go from seeing the first black hole ever to see all of them. It's like if the person next to Galileo built, you know, the Hubble Space Telescope, or so, the CMB. It's really crazy that we can do this in a single generation of detectors. All right, so why do I care if I see this plot and think immediately about binaries? Well, it's because, as it was also mentioned, I don't quite remember by who, maybe it was Tom, although I think it was yesterday, we have the expectation that astrophysical population of binaries will have a merger rate with, which evolves with the redshift, and that different channels may evolve differently as a function of redshift, right? So this is shown in this plot here, where on the x-axis I have redshift, this is far, and this is here, and on the y-axis the merger rate. The various color curves are prediction from population synthesis, so take them with a pinch of salt, of evolution of merger rate from binary in galactic fields, in globular cluster in blue, and from leftover black hole from the first population of stars, which very confusingly is called top three stars, right? And the vertical lines show you the horizon that current or future detector may see or may be sensitive to black holes as a function of redshift. And basically you can see, I think Tom mentioned this earlier, that advanced LIGO, 3 means a detector of 3 sites, will be able basically to just make it to the peak of star formation rate at around Z of 2-ish, but will entirely miss, if they are out there, mergers from black holes which are leftovers from population 3 stars. And of course, we would care about those because we have never seen a population 3 star directly, so it would be extremely consequential for our understanding of the first generation of stars to detect one of these. Go ahead, Sudhir.
Yeah, so what kind of delay distribution do you consider for
Say the again?
Delay time distribution?
No, for this one, I don't know. This comes directly from the literature, so this is already like including time delay distribution. Knowing the people who have done this, I assume it's some exponential time delay distribution, we know 100 million years okay. or a giga year or something like that. Okay, one other thing I want to stress though is that you know, C and DT would be basically here as I've shown. So really, not only you can characterize in an exquisite way the populations that we are already seeing today with LIGO and Virgo, but also access if they exist these other objects. An important thing I want to stress is that it's really important to have a network to measure for this type of science, not only for things like scale localization, which you know, for population of CBC may not be as important, but because of the extreme redshift of these objects and the fact that, as was mentioned a couple of days ago, what we measure is 1 plus z times the true mass of the objects. If we want to measure the true mass, we need to know the redshift, which means we need to know the distance. And to measure the distance, we need a network of detectors. So a single cosmic explorer or a single ET in isolation wouldn't be able to do as well. Okay, notice this plot stops at 15. As Tom said, there is, or there may be stuff farther away. Now I'm extending the x-axis to go to Z of 40. If they exist, primordial black hole are expected to have a merger rate which actually increases as you go farther down in the history of the universe, and be leaving a redshift of tens. And of course, detecting a primordial black hole in a merger would be extremely consequential. It could be a hint, could be a way of detecting dark matter. And as I discover, not the most dangerous way of discovering dark matter. I thought this was an April Fool paper, but actually it's a real paper. Because dark matter can kill you or seriously injure you. All right, so the last thing I want to say is that basically 90% of what I'm going to talk about was actually carried, and the heavy lifting was done by a student of mine, Ken, which very conveniently has a family name, which also is like next generation. Everything worked just perfectly well. All right, so let me spend some time talking about the astrophysical population of black holes, so non-primordial. Tom already mentioned and showed a version of, well, referred to a version of this plot, and said that we can reasonably expect that the formation rate of astrophysical black hole should track the formation rate of stars, right, of stellar material. And we know the star formation rate, SFR, right? This is a famous plot from Madhav and Dickinson, where you see an estimation for the log of the star formation as a function of Z, right? So we may expect that, we may think of using this and learn something about black holes. However, I want to do the other way around. The reason is that, as this quote nicely captured, it's very hard to measure the stellar mass of an object. I love this because it's very honest. This guy's a cosmologist. You never measure masses with photons. You always measure luminosity or frequencies, right? And then you have to extrapolate somehow from a luminosity count to a mass count and get that plot. So my favorite approach would be not to necessarily assume that this is true, but ask myself, can I measure the star formation rate with gravitational wave once I have access to this very high redshift? And the way that can be done, it's along the line of what Tom mentioned, is that you can assume, which is pretty reasonable, that the black hole merger rate is affected by a few factors, the main ones being a possibly metallicity-dependent star formation rate, so that's when the stars are available, plus, as Sudip was saying, a time delay distribution, because it takes some time from the formation of the star to the merger of the black hole. This is also called a TDD, time delay distribution. So if you like the math, Ricardo already had a little math, so these are my only two equations. What you can write is that the merger rate as some Zn is basically the integral of everything that was formed before that time and a time convolved with a time delay distribution that tells you how long it takes for you to merge. And the formation rate as some redshift, you can think about it as being proportional to the star formation rate. That's how much material you have available in the first place. And then there is another term, which Tom alluded to. This is a term that takes into account the metallicity dependence, because if you want to form big black hole, you need low metallicity. And this comes from the literature, of course, with some uncertainty. All right, in reality, even this is a oversimplification. There are more complicated things you should worry about, like the merger rate may also depend, or will probably depend, on intrinsic properties such as mass and spins. I'm entirely going to neglect this dependence. It can be added in the results I'm presenting if you want to. So with these pieces in mind, the question then we had was, can I use 3G data, next generation data, to measure these two key quantities instead of relying on astronomical measurements? And the way it would work is something like this. You start from the universe as some real that we don't know, star formation rate. So stars are formed according to some line here. Then you add some time delay. And depending on how large that time delay is, you will get the merger rate of black hole binaries as a function of z. If the delay is very large, of course, they will peak close to us, even though they formed at z of 2. If the delay is very small, they will peak at z of 2-ish, right? OK, so what we did in this particular analysis was to take some 3G data, consider these various options and possibilities for a time delay distribution. These are all exponentials. And this is the E fold. And the red one is flat in log of the time. And show that we 30,000 detections of binary black hole, which seems a lot. But depending on the time delay distribution, it's any period of time between a couple of weeks and a year or so. You can measure the merger rate, true merger rate as a function of z, pretty much using a Gaussian process, so in a model way that does not require you to know what the underlying true model is for these things, right? So this I found it particularly amazing, because it means in less than a year we'll basically be able to draw exactly the merger rate as a function of z. Of course, it's nice. It's not very useful, though, because if I give you one of these measurements, from here, you don't necessarily get the star formation rate or the time delay. You only get the merger rate. It would be nice to be able to deconvolve and get those other two quantities. That can be done, but it requires a model. So the way we have shown you can do it with a model is to assume that the star formation rate follows a Madau-Dickinson-like template, but we treat these various parameters as unknown that we measure from the data. And the time delay distribution as an exponential with a characteristic is e-fold that we also measure from the data. And we showed us with the 30,000 detection, you basically can measure the parameters of your SFR and the time delay distribution with uncertainty on the order of 10 to 50% depending on the parameters, which is particularly nice. However, big caveat, which I'll come back to over and over, your results are as good as your model, right? If your model sucks, your results would suck. Yeah, Ricardo. Yes, thank you, Ricardo. I should have said this. Yes, because what we measure is the luminosity distance and we need the redshift, we do fix the cosmology to the Planck value. Yeah, thank you. All right. And what I said is nice. However, it made a few simplifications, which I mentioned. One of them was to assume that all of the black holes in the universe follows the same, pretty much. No, not yet. The same path. In reality, as LIGO and Virgo's data are showing more and more, it's probably the case that there are more than one population of binary black holes out there, which each of which may follow a different path, evolutionary path, as a function of redshift. So in this paper here, we have basically augmented the analysis I just discussed to allow for the possibility of multiple astrophysical population, in particular two local, relatively local ones, field and dynamical channel, and the population tree that I discussed earlier. And we assumed and we checked what can be done with 2 months worth of detections, which again is tens of thousands of detection, depending exactly on you know, what model you assume. And the results I'm showing are with a network of two cosmic explorers and one Einstein telescope. So what can I do? What questions am I after? These are the questions I'm after. Can I measure the property of each of these channels individually? That's what we are already trying to do with LIGO and Virgo data, see if the spin distribution has any evidence or the mass distribution of different subpopulations. Can I measure the branching ratio between these channels? So tell you that X percent of the black hole come from the orange curve and Y percent from the blue. Can I show uncontroversially that population 3 black holes exist and when they existed? Yes, that's what I want to do. How would I do it? Well, to do it, the easiest, most straightforward way is to get a model that tell me how, give me a way to label each black hole such that I can tell you this black hole comes from this channel, but that black hole comes from that channel. So in the ideal world scenario, I would like population synthesis or theory to give me prediction that I can trust for the mass and spin and eccentricity and redshift evolution of each channel individually. This is the approach that was followed for the existing set of data by Mike Zevin et al, where they have prediction from common envelope, Robura cluster, nuclear star clusters, and so on and so forth. Now, that's the ideal world. As Mike himself would tell you, we don't live in a world. We live in this world where population synthesis gave us predictions which are highly uncertain locally and even more so for population 3. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Thank you. For people on Zoom, so Tom rightly noticed that not only they are uncertain, the prediction, but sometimes they conflict with what we already see. Okay. So the way we then decided to proceed, or one of the way, is to try to use as little information as possible from this prediction. In particular, throw away everything they predict about masses and spins, because clearly we are seeing that these predictions are, you know, still being updated, and instead only rely on the prediction they make about the redshift evolution, okay? So all the inference I'm gonna show you only relies on measuring the redshift of these binaries and throw away any mass and spin information that may be there. Okay, so to do that then, we take a model that only gives us the merger rate as a function of Z, and we parameterize each of these populations individually. For example, for population 3, it will look like this function here. I don't know if it has a name, but it depends on three variables, basically a slope, a low redshift, a slope, a high redshift, and the peak. If you have a model for each of the population, I'm not gonna show the other two because they're mathematically long, then you can show that you can measure the individual contribution of each of these channels to the total merger rate as a function of Z. Here I'm assuming, as I said, 2 months of data, and I'm assuming that the ratio, the branching ratio of orange and blue, it's 50-50 pretty much. And in this universe here, I'm assuming that there are no population 3 black hole. I'm assuming that astronomers got it entirely wrong and pop 3 stars don't form black hole, or if they do, they are too big for us to be detected in LIGO, in Cosmic Explorer NDT. And the question is, can I show that this is zero? Well, This plot shows you that your inference on the population tree star, it's very, very low. It's much lower than the total. So you may be convincing yourself that indeed there are no pop tree black holes. I'm going to show a better plot in a second. On the other end, if your universe does feature a small fraction of a population tree black hole, 2.5%, then with a couple of months of data, you can very nicely measure that contribution to your merger rate. Yeah, go ahead. The redshift. Basically, I'm using what am I using if I'm not using masses and spins to make the inference? And the answer is redshift. Basically, I'm assuming that I have a function that, given some parameters, tell me how each of these population should evolve as a function of zip. Okay, and then I throw that into an inference where simultaneously all of these three populations are inferred from the data. No, they're different. So they are inspired by either theory, in the case of either theory or population synthesis, pretty much. So this green one, it's this expression here. The blue is a log normal. And the orange, it's Madau-Dickinson SFR, of course, with different parameters than Madau and Dickinson. As a function, it looks like Madau-Dickinson. OK, this plot is nice, but it doesn't show you what kind of constraint I can put on the fraction of pop tree stars. This is what can be done. So here I'm assuming that I'm showing the results where cluster and field have the same rate, so branching ratio of 0.5 between the two of them. And in particular, this plot here shows you my measurement on the fraction, on the branching ratio on population tree star, either for a universe in purple where there are no pop tree star, so I would like to put an upper limit, or in a universe where there are population tree stars given by the black thick line. And again, with a couple of months worth of data, I can pretty much pin down this measurement to a very nice level of precision. Things depend slightly, and how well I can do this, on what the clusters and field are doing. Here, again, I put them at 50-50. But we also shown in this plot here how my inference on the branching ratio of pop tree star depends on the true fraction of black holes in the globular cluster channel as opposed to field channel. The reason why I would care about it is because the field channel has a much fatter tail than the globular cluster. So if you have a lot of those in the universe, then you can confuse them a bit with the green. While if you have a lot of the blue ones, it's much harder to confuse them because they taper off earlier. That's why this measurement gets better to the right, which is increasing the fraction of blue relative to orange. But again, the point is that regardless of whether there are or not pop tree stars, pop tree black holes, we will be able to measure their fraction at an incredibly good level already with a couple of months worth of data.
Hello, I have a question. Yeah.
Yes, Susie.
In the next slide, when you're showing the distribution, because the look back time at the high redshift is small, so even if there is a larger delay time, I expect the green peak can significantly shift towards left.
Yes, of course.
But then there can be a further confusion also between the blue curve and the green curve.
Of course. So you're perfectly right. So in here, we took this green curve we took it from papers by population studies by Belchinsky et al. And of course, there are other groups doing similar studies in Japan in particular. As far as I remember, they get similar values for like the horizontal position. Things are very uncertain also on the vertical position.
True.
Of course, this merger rate may be much lower, in which case, but you're right. If this peaks here,
slightly
it's going to be much harder.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, you're right. Okay, and so the last thing I want to say then about this exactly is, can I measure then when this happens? Because of course, it would be a nice way of setting a T0 for us, my friends in astrophysics, that tells them when most of pop tree remnants merge. And I can, because that's exactly one of the parameters of my model. It's this Z3 is the Z of the peak. And the inference you get, again, depends on the true value of the other two channel ratio. But you can see that you can measure the true value of the peak of the pop tree, which is the white square, with uncertainty of the order of maybe 3 in redshift and 90% uncertainty. Now, this is beautiful. You can also measure the branching ratio between the two other channels. Do I have another 5 hours? How long do I have? 15, okay. Then in interest of time, let me not spend all the time about this. The point is that you can measure the branching ratio between all of these channels with relatively good uncertainty with a couple of months of data. Important caveat, the results I showed need an uncertainty on the redshift. As of now, the results I've shown you are based on a forecast obtained with IMR Phenom PV2, which means there are no higher order modes. Okay, we have heard over and over in the previous days about higher order modes, and we have heard from Patricia how they can help measuring better distance and inclination. So take these results as a kind of worst case scenario, because with HM waveforms, we are gonna do a bit better, and I can come back to this point in a second to show how much better. Okay, this is beautiful, but those of you like me and Tom who have spent enough time with people that do population synthesis will be skeptical and ask, is there anything we can do if we really don't trust our friends that do population synthesis? Can we learn anything at all that does not rely on me having a functional form for how this channel evolves as a function of Z? The answer is yes. It's, well, A, I like your skepticism. And yes, we can do something about it. Of course, we have to give up the idea of measuring each of these things separately and only focus on measuring the total merger rate, so the black distribution. That can be done with the same method I shown earlier, based on Gaussian process regression, pretty much. So what I'm showing here, for a universe where you have 2.5% of POP3, and for a universe where there are no POP3 star, how, again, with a couple of months worth of data, you can use an entirely unmodeled approach, Gaussian process, and measure the total merger rate, not the individual contribution. At this point, what you can try to do, the only thing really you can try to do, forget about the branching ratio, this is all too complicated, but you can try to look for maxima or stationary point of the total merger rate to see if there is a peak. In particular, a peak, a very high redshift. If you see this peak, you may say, huh, population 3 black holes exist, and that's where they peaked. And that's exactly what Ken coded up, a simple stationary point finding algorithm. And this is what you obtain. This is a posterior, a very blocky posterior for the number of peak in your merger rate history without POP3 star and with POP3 star. And the point being that if you have POP3 star, you can see that there is a secondary peak in the redshift, while without population 3 stars, you get one peak only. When I say only, there is a caveat. You see sometimes a small, you know, excursion to 3 or 1. That's because, you know, depending on how the Gaussian process fluctuates, you may fool yourself a bit. But the idea is that even with this approach, which knows nothing about the underlying populations, you can look for these two peaks, 1 and 2, count how many of them you have, and plot their position. So in here, I'm plotting my estimation of where the low redshift peak happens. So this is Z lower, with or without POP3 stars, and as a function of the true branching ratio between the two other populations. And you can see that it's pretty beautiful. It can be done. The uncertainty is not great, but again, this is a couple of months of data. Plot on the right as in green, the results for my inference of the high redshift peak with the model approach. And now in orange, I've added my inference with this unmodeled approach. And the beautiful thing is that they agree. So this shows that even if you don't trust astronomers, you can still measure the peak, the high redshift peak of the total merger rate using a GPR, and you get something which is typically a bit more uncertain, but also more reassuring because it comes with less modeling. Okay, I'm trying to check whether Luis is getting nervous with time, so let me maybe quickly go to my next topic, which is primordial black holes. I already mentioned, shown this plot. Primordial black holes, if they exist, they might have peculiar property. We may be able to say something about their mass and spin spectrum, the eccentricity maybe, because of the way they're born. And their redshift distribution. Now, all of these things come with uncertainty because, well, we have never seen primordial black holes, right? Of those, at least to me and to the people I talk to, the less controversial thing seems to be that their redshift should be very, very high, okay? So if you are after proving to the world that you have seen a primordial black hole in a binary, probably the safest thing is to go after very high redshift and tell yourself, if I observe a binary black hole, a redshift of larger than, say, 30, so here, it's gonna be primordial because there are no stars in the universe at that point yet, okay? So this could be a good way of showing that you have found a primordial black hole. You detect something, and it's a Z of 40, 50. Can we do that? Yes. If you go back to the plot I showed you earlier with the total mass and the horizon, you can see that C and DT can detect black hole binary above Z of 30 in the region between 10, say, and 100 solar masses or so. So again, that would be my smoking gun. However, and there's been a lot of confusion in the literature about this, being able to detect something at Z of 40 does not mean that you can prove that it happened at Z of 40. And the reason is that we suck at measuring distances, typically, right? So one of the things we wanted to check was, suppose that I have such a merger and I will detect it. Can I actually make the case with certainty that it's that merger happened above some critical value of Z, after which I don't believe stars exist, right? Say 30, you know, people use 30 based on some theory prediction. So the answer is not really. It's actually pretty hard because we don't measure distances well. So in this plot here, we are showing as a function of the true redshift at which you place your binary, and these are the properties of this binary, it's 40 solar mass, Q01, pi over 3 iota. The reason why we pick this is because that's actually the best system. And these violins show you the 90%, well, the old posterior, on your estimation of Z. We have offset that by Z true so that everything is lined up to zero, more or less, using ACE and 180 in red, or ACE, 180, and a 20 kilometer ACE in Australia. It doesn't change very much, but for completeness. And what you can see is that if you place your binary black hole far enough, the uncertainties, the 90% uncertainties in the redshift are of the order of, you know, 10, 15, 20, and this is with higher order modes. This is with the grand waveform. It's AMR phenom PXM, right? So this is telling us that it's gonna be, you can say something like, you know, the best system has 97% of its posterior above Z of 30, but that's not certainty. It's very likely, it's not certain. To make things even worse, when you do Bayesian inference, as we have heard over and over, you need a prior. In obtaining these posteriors, we have used a prior which is basically uniform in comoving volume. But on top of that, and source time, but on top of that, you may also want to fold in an astrophysical prior about, you know, the relative ratio of these populations. And it turns out that that's, unsurprisingly, a very significant impact on your result. So what I'm showing here, it's for my best system, so this 40 solar mass, you know, Q equal 1 and pi 1 over 3, how my measurement on the redshift, and in particular whether it's larger than 30, so on the right of the gray area, changes as I change my prior belief on the relative rate of population 3 versus primordial black hole at Z of 30. So the black line is my default uniform incongruent volume, and I get roughly 97% of the posterior on the right hand side of Z equal 30. The color curves are in decreasing order here. The ratio of primordial black hole to population 3 star at Z of 30 that I use a priori. And unsurprisingly, what this is telling you is that how much you believe this particular binary black hole to be primordial depends a lot on how many primordial black holes you believe there are in the first place, though, okay? So I'll go back to this in a second. I'm just telling you that you're trying to do something probably a bit silly. Yeah, go ahead.
But these you're not considering anything on the mass gap, because from the mass, restricted mass, you will have some estimates of its typical values, because you know that there should be an astrophysical mass gap because of PISN. If you go to something like 40, I expect these sources will be way above 100 solar mass in this detector frame.
Yes.
So you are not using that information in these results?
No, here I'm being agnostic on the astrophysics.
Okay.
Ricardo.
I have the impression that you get that large error on redshift, even though the luminosity distance might be measured quite accurately, because the relationship redshift-luminosity distance of those distances is very steep, right? Mm-hmm. So a small error in luminosity distance, gives you a huge range in Z. So would that third detector help? I mean, reducing even a few percent in luminosity distance might give a strong help in redshift.
A third detector, say. Here we do have three detectors. Like this one, the blue side of this, it's three detector. It's not quite equivalent because this one is 20 kilometers instead of 20.
Okay, actually, I have a preliminary study with my student. You need a detector far apart. Actually, if you assume one in Arizona and one in Holland, say, the best detection to increase luminosity distance precision is either Brazil or Japan. I mean, it's really far apart.
This one is in Australia. It will be one in
Australia.
Here,
sorry.
One in Australia, okay. One in S stands for South.
South, okay.
We took it Australia. Anyhow, we can, of course, more detectors are always better, as we hopefully know. Okay, so one segue of this is that we started checking what happens with other parameters when you're dealing with black holes at very large redshifts. In particular, looking at things like the effect of higher order modes. So it's going to be really mainly me advertising how much we own to Garant for developing these beautiful and fast waveforms. So we are wrapping up a study where we check pretty much the impact of higher order modes for those systems and correlations that may arise. So for example, in here, I'm showing for a black hole with a true total mass of 40, Q1 and 30 degrees of inclination, how well I can measure is a redshift, again, offset by the true value, as a function of the true redshift. And on the top panel here, you see the signal-to-noise ratio in my network, with or without the higher-order modes, left or right. And this inference is performed either with Phenomex PHM in blue, or with PV2, which does not have any higher-order modes. The injection always match the P waveform, so there is no waveform systematics here, okay? And as you can imagine, of course, higher order modes help more and more as you go farther and farther away, because of what Sudobi was saying, things are reshifted to lower and lower frequencies, so the merger ring down, which is where the HMs are more important, become more and more relevant. But the point is that it's not a factor of 10 improvement, it's order of a factor of 2 maybe, for the farthest objects we have considered. The nice thing that comes also out of this is that you can go after correlation, because there are parameters that affect how many higher order modes we see in the data, right? One of these parameters is the inclination. The closer you are to pi over 2, the more higher order mode matters. So because higher order mode help you break in distance, inclination, and degeneracy, you would expect your uncertainty on the redshift to get better and better as you go to a higher inclination. Do you? No. Because reality is more complicated and there are two competing effects. From one side, as you go from 0 to 90 degrees, you are getting more and more higher order mode effect. But on the other side, you are losing signal to noise ratio. So there is a sweet spot where these two effects are kind of bands. But if you go farther away, close to pi over 2, you're losing too much SNR, other way around. In the intermediate region, you're losing too much SNR for the HM to compensate. When you are very close to pi over 2, the HM help a lot. So to give you a scale, the SNR here is 33, the SNR here is 12 only, and you get a very similar measurement, right? The other thing I want to say, which I think is pretty neat, and I didn't appreciate until this, I'm sure Garant has known this for years, is that it is not always the case that the waveform with higher order modes has an higher SNR. Like in here, close to phase on, yes, Phenom XM has an SNR of 33 and Phenom P2 of 31. But here, it's the other way around. So what we think the interpretation is, and Garant, tell me if I'm wrong, is that higher order mode can basically interfere partially destructively and give you a lower SNR than you would if you just took the 2-2 mode. Okay, a similar thing happens with the mass ratio that also impacts on any higher order mode, how much the higher order mode matter. And again, there is not necessarily a linear trend. As you go to larger mass ratio, you get higher order modes, which are more and more important, but you also lose SNR, again, keeping everything else fixed. So your posterior does not necessarily get better and better. In fact, in this case, you lose a bit. The sweet spot is probably between 2 and 1, 2 and 1 and 2. And again, either for those of you who like or have relied in the past on studies based on IMARTIN on PB2, you want to be careful because at these distances, it matters a lot. Yeah, and basically done. The last thing maybe about this, which I thought was very nice, is that we have found a correlation which probably has been known by someone, but not by me at least, between the mass ratio and iota, right? Typically, we think of iota as being correlated with the distance. But if you have enough higher order modes, because Q also enters the amplitude expansion in higher order modes, you get that Q and iota are correlated. This is shown by this blue contour here for IMR phenom XPHM, where by increasing Q, you have to decrease cos iota to get the same mesh of the data pretty much. And of course, you have an entirely different situation when you only have the 2-2 mode of phenom P. Okay, last thing, spins. Another way in which you may think about getting a primordial black hole is that they're expected to have zero spin at formation. So if you detect something at Z of 50, you're gonna ask yourself, does it have zero spin? The answer is maybe does. In this case, our simulation did have zero spin, but your measurement of the spin, which is the color violin, at Z larger than 30 or so is gonna be incredibly uncertain. Not surprising, the SNRs are of the order of tens. By the way, think about this. These are things on the other side of the universe that they have the same SNR as we are getting now in LIGO and Virgo. Okay, so I guess the final thought is that if you want to go after primordial black hole, don't try to get the idea of detecting one of them and making the case that that one was primordial, go after the population, right? If there is a primordial black hole population, you could try to see if your merger rate, a very high redshift, at some point starts increasing as a function of Z, as is expected for primordial black hole with some known slope as a function of time. And again, you can play the same game. If you believe your friend's theorist, use some model for the populations. If you don't believe your friends, theorists, and pop synth people, you use a Gaussian process or something like that. And again, you can try to check whether there is any evidence that the total merger rate, the black curve, doesn't go down monotonically, but instead kind of gets flat or increase even, depending on what the real rate of PBH is. And before Luis gets aggressive, this is my conclusion slides. I guess the one point I want to stress again because of the students in the room is that if you like this kind of science, get involved. There is numerous way of getting, of playing a role with C and the T. And you know, because of the time scale, these objects will be relevant when you yourself have students, right? So you want to get a head start. Thank you.
I was not gonna be aggressive. So questions? Anyone from the online world? No questions?
So we have we got a few throughout.
That's okay. So Suvadip.
Yeah, so
the second one already.
What about the stochastic background from PBHs? How do you think that will be competing with the individual one?
Well, you tell me. I had a mental note for myself to say this. Of course, as you have shown on the discussion session earlier, there are other ways of going after this kind of analysis without relying on resolvable sources, as I've done. What I'm doing here relies that, or imply, or assumes that I'm seeing all of these black holes one by one individually in the data. As Tom has shown us earlier, and Sudip too, you can go after similar studies using the unresolved sum of all of these sources. I would expect this to, well, I guess the which one is more powerful depends on what the truth is about the merger rate, which we don't know. If this is low enough, I would think that the two metals should kind of converge, right? If this is high enough, I would expect that being able to see them will give you more information. But I don't have two numbers I can easily compare. So
maybe what I want to also say that maybe LVK or OA plus will be a kind of a pathfinder for what is there at higher shift through the stochastic. And you can expect right. What you can expect as an individual event from CEET.
Yeah, of course.
So we can already give some estimates as a, from the already one which is coming.
I think that's a very interesting and relevant thing that you know people like you and Tom should explore, which is how much do we learn between now and 2035 can and should be used as a prior for the analysis that we will be doing then, right? To me, like maybe I'm over conservative, but as probably you have figured out from our discussion about H naught and inclination, you know, it's great to use priors that are motivated by other things, but it's also then the result is as good as your prior. Okay, so one may want to try, but I also like things like this, and that's why you know I always told Ken we should really look into Gaussian processes without models, because that's to me sets the lower bar. That's the very minimum we can do. Then if we have model and we trust them, we can do better than this. But this is already pretty impressive.
I have a basic question. Why do you expect primordial black holes to be created with zero spin?
Right, so this is, okay, I feel embarrassed because there are people in the room that know this much better than I do, but basically it's because of the way they are formed from, if we're talking about primordial black hole, right? Do you understand the question?
Sorry?
It was about primordial black holes?
Yes, yes.
It's basically because of the way they're expected to form from collapse of other densities in the very, very early universe, and that collapse being highly symmetric should leave you with something without spin. And then, later in their life, they can acquire so a redshift, you know, of 10 or lower, maybe. If you find one then, it may be spinning because he had all of this time to spin up accreting matter around it. But at the beginning, they're expected to be without spin. So, Luis, you and others that know this better should correct me if it's wrong.
Sounds perfectly sound to me, though.
That's why you know we want to see whether we could prove that spins are zero, and you know it's hard at those redshifts.
Okay, so it's basically due to the collapse of the density to be symmetric.
Yeah.
Thanks.